Subscribe to The Spectator today and make your prediction for the 2024 US election winner. If you choose correctly, you'll receive a £30 Amazon gift card and the chance to win a case of Paul Roger champagne. Go to spectator.co.uk/decide24.
Hello and welcome to The Americano Show. I'm Kate Andrews and I'm guest hosting for Freddie Gray while he's over in the States. We'll be getting reports from him this week on the U.S. election and be speaking to many other guests. Now on with the show. Hello and welcome to The Americano Show. I'm Kate Andrews, your guest host this week, and I'm joined by Rick MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You are in the UK today, here with me. We're happy to have you here at The Spectator, but you're jumping on a flight. You're racing to the States so you can cast your vote in person. Why do you feel so strongly you want to vote tomorrow in person? There are other ways to do it. You could have had a longer holiday in Britain.
Yeah, well, I that's what my wife actually suggested to me. But what I really believe in is what we sort of sentimentally call a Republican, and I mean as in the Republic, not the Republican Party, mass, a kind of civil mass, secular mass, where everybody comes together on the same day and agrees on the rules that day and the format that day. It's a universal kind of participation in democracy. I don't like the idea that you can sort of drag your feet. I mean, jump the line and vote before election day has actually happened, because who knows, you might learn something between the early voting day and election day that would change your mind. But you're also not participating in the democracy with your other Republican citizens in solidarity with them.
I really do miss the participation.
And there's a loss of solidarity in the country that's just profound. Mm. And on a practical level, people voting by mail early is destructive because it's inviting challenges from the loser. The more mail-in ballots there are, more paper mail-in ballots that could have been manipulated or torn or just damaged or whatever, the more Trump's going to scream if he loses. And the Democrats will scream also.
I want to come back to that, the rules of engagement, so to speak, and early voting and when votes get counted and what's going to happen. Before we come to all of that, I want to ask you about this new poll that was published over the weekend for Iowa, not really considered to be one of the key swing states in this election. People have thought it's comfortably going to fall in Donald Trump's camp, showing Kamala Harris 3 points ahead. It's an outlier poll, but it seems to fit with the sense we've had over the weekend. And it should be said, this is going on vibes alone, because nobody knows what's going to happen. But the feeling over the weekend has been a slight shift towards the Harris camp. What do you make of it?
Well, it would be the conventional wisdom expanded greatly that women, including Republican and conservative women, even evangelical women, are going to vote for Trump because they hate what Trump did to legal abortion. Now, they also could be exaggerated. It could be just self-fulfilling and people trying to push other women to come out and vote in other states by saying, look, even in Iowa, women are conservative Republican women are voting for Harris and so are going to vote for Harris. I think ultimately it's still mostly a referendum on Trump himself. Do you want a half-mad businessman? It's hard to call him a businessman. I mean, I don't think Trump is competent to break a restaurant workers' strike. I don't think he can do... The idea that he's going to be more dangerous this time than the last time, to me, is absurd because he's clearly gone off the rails. Yesterday in Pennsylvania, he went off script and said, I shouldn't have left the White House. I should have just stayed. The election was stolen, and it's going to be stolen again.
You don't think that makes him more dangerous now?
No, I think it just makes him crazier. I mean, I think people around him, we have institutions in the country that are designed to protect the Congress, the two other branches of government, from the executive branch. And I think even the most rock-ribbed Trumpy, if he sees Trump trying to actually grab power illegally or unconstitutionally, like Pence did, a very right-wing Republican, they're going to put their feet down. They're not going to let him do it. And I think his advisors are going to say, look, you don't want to play into this fantasy of the liberals that you're a fascist, that you really want to you're going for a coup d'etat. And when he talks like that, it plays right into the Democratic Party's talking points. He's a fascist. He wants to take over. He doesn't seem capable. He can't even stay on script.
That is the line that the Democrats seem to be closing this election with.
Right.
Their line is that Trump is dangerous. Trump is fascist. You can't elect him.
Right.
And the polling suggests that is not the most successful line for the Democrats. That actually, if this Iowa poll is correct, and if Harris ends up having a comfortable win tomorrow evening,
right.
it's probably because of abortion, and it's probably because the female turnout was so large. On the flip side, if Trump wins, it's because the white working class voter still feels like they're not being listened to.
Yeah. Not only aren't they being listened to, the cost of living is a big issue. It's not quite as big an issue as abortion, I don't think. But the cost of living has turned a lot of people and independents against the Democratic Party. But you still have this phenomenon among the white the working class. It's whites, blacks, Hispanics, who lost their jobs because of Clinton's policies in the 90s, his allegedly free trade policies, NAFTA, and permanent normal trade relations with China, which sent millions of factory jobs to Mexico and China. These people, I wrote a whole book about it. I've done a huge amount of reporting since then in Ohio, especially. They're still furious with the Democratic Party for destroying their culture. It's not just when you lose your job, you're out of luck and you're making less money. It also kills the local culture. The bowling alley goes out of business. The local coffee shop goes out of business. The school system is underfunded because the factory paid a lot of property taxes. It's got a domino effect, and it's been so demoralizing for the working class in America. I'm talking Clintonomics, neoliberal Clintonomics, that I've talked to union members. I have a friend, Bob Teeple, who lost his job at the Autolite spark plug plant in Fostoria, Ohio, because it moved to Mexico, thanks to NAFTA. He's now got a job. He's working at the Stellantis plant, Jeep plant in Toledo. But I talked to him a couple of months ago. He says, Trump's our only hope. And he's a UAW member. He used to be a United Auto Workers member. He used to be the chairman of his local. In Fostoria, there are certain people in the American working class who will never, ever vote Democratic again. And when they hear Harris, who's frankly a weak candidate, she doesn't say anything. She speaks in cliches, bromides, and so on, positive future. She doesn't address what these people are upset about.
And that seems to have been fairly deliberate on the part of her campaign strategy.
Absolutely.
Let's come back to Harris. Riddle me this on Trump, though. Between 2016 to 2020, he talked a protectionist game. He talked about America first. He talked about bringing jobs back. Now, a lot of Americans look fondly and nostalgically back at Trump's economy, and there were some trade wars. You know, he did some for show, relatively superficial, although I'm not saying they didn't have an impact on the economy. They did. But Trump actually, in 2016 onwards, he operated as a pretty laissez-faire, pretty normal Republican. I mean, the policies he was putting in were not all that different from some of those neoliberal policies that you were just saying that these voters hate. He got the economy going. He got wages up. It seems this time around, the policies that worked for him in 2016, even if he didn't fully admit to them, he really is going to move away from, and he's going to try full-on protectionism. Do you think he's actually going to do it? And do you think it would be beneficial if he did?
Well, I don't know if it'd be beneficial if he did, because the carts, you know, the horses, carts gotten away. I mean, Trump, what he did was he did put selective tariffs on, which Biden has now copied. He's got this, Biden changed nothing. Biden's tariff policy is exactly the same as Trump's tariff policy in after 2016. But what he also did was reform NAFTA. He replaced it with something called USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. And what it did was help the Mexican auto workers slightly, more than it helped American workers. And he goes around saying, I'm a great reformer. NAFTA's the worst trade policy ever negotiated by the United States. But what he replaced it with actually helped the Mexican auto workers more than American auto workers. It forces wages up for Mexican auto workers in order to for the auto companies to qualify for tariff-free exports to the United States. The real problem is that NAFTA and the new agreement are investment insurance. If the Mexican government ever expropriates, you're guaranteed a refund paid in a G7 currency. So factories are still closing in the United States. Master Lock's last little bit in Milwaukee just closed a few months ago, because you'd have to be an idiot if you're running a factory or running a corporation not to take advantage of $1.50 an hour wages in Mexico, where people can make the same thing for less than half the cost than it costs in Milwaukee or Chicago. So the outflow is still happening, and Trump didn't really address it.
Well, speaking of rhetoric versus public policy reality, let's move on to Harris, because her campaign seems to think that the correct tactic has been actually quite odd to do a media blitz, but also to really try very hard not to say too much, if anything at all, when it comes to key areas of public policy, especially around energy, around fracking, around healthcare. We know that she's held some more politically left positions in recent history. I mean, going into the 2020 primaries for the Democrats, Kamala Harris was talking about Medicare for all. She was talking about bringing an end to fracking. She hasn't wanted to talk about it on the campaign. If she wins, is America in for either a happy or a rude awakening, depending on whether or not you agree with those policies? Or do you think they actually do have a sense of who she is as a candidate, even though she won't always say it out loud?
What matters is the Democratic Party hierarchy knows what kind of a candidate she is, and she's totally reliable. She follows orders. They wouldn't have given her the nomination if she wasn't absolutely loyal to the party hierarchy. She knows that she cannot deviate from the Biden line on anything. You saw famously, she said in the interview when they asked her, what would you do different if you'd been president? And she said, nothing.
Nothing
comes to mind.
Not one thing.
And that's exactly what the party bosses want from a candidate. They'd rather lose with a reliable hack, which she is, than win with somebody a little more eccentric or a little bit more independent. If she gets in, you'll have a continuation of Biden's policies. What I hope will happen is that she'll maintain at least his antitrust policy. And there's a very strange thing about Biden and Harris and the party. The two best things they've done, from my point of view, which Trump supported, by the way, was get out of Afghanistan, which was a very good thing to do, and to install serious people at the head of the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Department of the Justice Department. So now Biden has the best antitrust policy we've had in 50 years. But curiously, nobody in the Democratic Party talks about it because they know it'll anger donors. It'll anger Microsoft, Google, Apple, Facebook, et cetera, which hate antitrust. They're being sued right now by the federal government. And Afghanistan upsets the defense establishment. And the defense contractors who make their money off of the cost-plus weapons programs interventions like Afghanistan pay. So they just don't say a word about their two best policies. Some people think that Harris will bow down to her big tech contributors and fire Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission, which would be symbolically wonderful for big tech, and a horror for the people who are, like me, who are being eaten alive by big tech. I'm talking about Harper's Magazine. So I think she's going to be a real mainstream consensus Democrat within the party. And she'll talk big about raising wages and so on and so forth, but she'll still listen to the donors first, big tech and Wall Street, and she'll listen to the Clintons and the Obamas.
On abortion, do you think she is setting herself up, if she were to win, for some potential failures? It seems very unlikely that if Harris goes into the Oval Office, that Congress is likely to be filled with the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate. They're not looking at having all three. And I think that the promise to create some kind of federal law on abortion obviously going to be scuppered every single step of the way by wherever the Republicans end up. Now, I've also always thought, well, I've thought for some time, ever since Roe was overturned, that the Democrats did have a narrow window right when that happened with some liberal Republicans throughout Congress to try to come up with just even the lightest of guarantees for women across the United States, something like a 12-week access to abortion. Then other states could have that higher if they wanted. Some states wouldn't go past that. They like to campaign on the issue. In many ways, they've chosen not to address it all the ways that they could. Do we think Harris is setting people up for disappointment? Do we think she wants to keep campaigning on the issue? Because, of course, she'll be looking at a second term. And if women come out overwhelmingly for Harris and they don't get access to what they consider to be these crucial abortion rights, will she have to pay for that at some point in the polls?
I would think so. You've said it better than I can possibly say it.
Don't know about that.
You understand the issue perfectly. The Democrats didn't want to lose the abortion issue. They wanted to run on it.
Yes.
Better that than run on, you know, against the ultra wealthy, the super wealthy, or big tech.
But also, perhaps worse, and this is very cynical, they didn't want to win on the issue.
Right.
They didn't want to ensure that there was that baseline access.
And there are state issues involved. I mean, because there's certain Democrats like Tester in Montana, who a national abortion rule, say 12 weeks of access, it wouldn't have helped him. It might have hurt him. Looks like Tester may go down anyway, but there's a lot of state politics, and also they're afraid of offending Catholics because there are a lot of Catholics who are silently opposed to abortion. They just don't say it out loud in polite company. Mm-hmm. Female Republican Protestants are more willing to say out loud, well, yeah, a woman should have a right to choose, and they're not left-wing. But Biden himself is in a kind of a dilemma because he's Catholic. And he's somehow managed to get away with it up to now. And I don't know, maybe they're afraid of rocking the boat with the Catholic hierarchy in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, wherever.
Certainly in Pennsylvania.
Certainly in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, where I think in 2020, the exit poll captured that about 30% of voters identified as Catholic. Really substantial.
There you go.
In terms of not wanting to fully commit to one position or another, there was some interesting reporting over the weekend that the Harris campaign was running sympathetic ads in Michigan towards Gaza, and some of the comments she's made there, and then some very strong pro-Israeli ads in Pennsylvania, almost forgetting about the digital age that we live in, and these can easily be put side by side. I mean, again, this is Harris, the candidate who doesn't want to commit to a position. It goes back to that point you made about trying to make this a referendum on Donald Trump. But when Americans have just had several years of a really tough economy, they've gone through inflation, they're not feeling very well off, it's very difficult to run a campaign and not say what you're going to do. Tricky for Trump as well when you say you're going to do some pretty eccentric stuff, but perhaps even harder to be Harris and to not want to say at all really what the plan is.
Yeah, well, it's not hard if you're a reliable party hack. Remember, Kamala Harris was trained in politics by Willie Brown, her one-time boyfriend, who was the boss of the California State Democratic Party, and I'm sure he taught her the rules of the game. Loyalty to party comes first. Okay. And if you rock the boat, you don't listen to your bosses or your boss's representatives, because I'm sure there are political consultants swarming all over her. She has my sympathy, sent by the central committee of the party saying, talk peace in Michigan and talk, what was it in Pennsylvania?
Very pro-Israeli stance.
Pro-Israeli in Pennsylvania. And she does what she's told and she can respond. But that doesn't mean she's not uncomfortable with it. She might have impulses we don't know about where she'd like to be able to say the Israeli slaughter has gone on too long. I mean, we're all defend Israel's right to exist, but this is just too much. It's over the top. And I'm breaking with President Biden on this. That would win her Michigan. But she won't say it.
But there are several other camps to think about, not just the Democratic operatives. And I take your point as the candidate in a still very structured and established party, which has not sort of been turned on its head as the Republican Party has. And the infrastructure has been turned on its head. Everything's become MAGA so quickly.
Right.
And the Democratic Party, where that hasn't happened and things actually remain incredibly structured and very mainstream, you have to play ball. But voters want to know more. I mean, I can't really think of a time where voters were given less information about what a candidate might do in office, except perhaps Trump in 2016, because he was still figuring it out. Build a wall became a policy because he said it at a few rallies and people cheered and he thought, okay, well, here's our immigration policy. But it's hard to think of the last time a candidate revealed so little. And also, I don't think we're getting the feeling that Harris is just desperate to share her views, and if only she were unleashed, she'd be allowed to.
Yeah.
You get the feeling that she'd like to avoid putting some things on the record as much as possible.
Yeah.
And voters are picking up on it.
Yeah, that she's conflict averse. She doesn't want to get into an argument with anybody. Yeah. She's happy. She liked being a prosecutor, but then the deck is stacked against the defendant. You've got the state of California against some schlump who's accused of some major crime. It's easy to talk at someone like that and to talk at a jury. But in a debate, I will say, people keep saying that she won the debate against Trump. Well, she won by not talking. Mm-hmm. She just let Trump talk like a crazy man, which is what he did. That's how she won.
She set him off brilliantly.
Yeah, and she set him off. She made fun of him, which was good. But she didn't really argue with him on anything substantive. And she still hasn't, as far as I can tell, made a substantive proposal. She doesn't even, I guess she talks vaguely about raising the federal minimum wage, but I don't think she really believes in it. And again, on the really sensitive question of antitrust and war, she just doesn't say what she believes, whether she believes in it or not. Does she believe in fighting Putin to the death, and funding the Ukrainians for the next 10 years? We don't know. We don't know. I mean, Putin is ready to fight to the death, but she's not saying whether the American government is willing to fight to the death forever. It's not a great augur. It's not a great sign that she seems to be so conflict averse. Mm. But again, remember, she was imposed on us. She was imposed by the party. There was no mini primary. I mean, there could have been. The two people I would have nominated ahead of her were Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, who's very smart, and it would have carried Michigan without a problem, and Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who I'm told, everyone would say, well, we can't have Sherrod Brown run for president. He has to hold his seat in Ohio. But apparently his seat in Ohio is not so safe. Brown was an outlier in the Democratic Party. He opposed all the free trade deals. As a congressman and then as a senator, he's MAGA-proof.
MAGA-proof.
and he's tough. He's very tough. But now, from what I hear, he's in a very tight race in Ohio. And if he loses it, and Harris loses, well, anyway, I'm not predicting anything. But
I'm not going to push that on you. It feels like an unfair thing to do hours before Americans will start to vote. I know you've been in the UK for a quick trip, but you're based in the States. That's where you've been in the run up to this election. What are you sensing from voters? How is it feeling? Is it truly as impossible to predict as everybody says?
Yes, but what I get from my friends is a sense of despair. You know, most of my friends are on the left, I would say. You know, they're liberal or on the left. But I know right wingers, and I talk to a lot of right wingers. But there is, I think, a sense of despair about the mediocrity of the campaign, the fact that there is nothing substantively being debated. And what I find also very amusing is that the liberal media, which I compete against, I mean, you can take this for what it is, but the New Yorker and the New York Times, in about the last 2 months, have suddenly discovered the working class and suddenly discovered that the working class is angry and alienated. And their response, their reporting, some of it's better. This guy Dan Kaufman in the New York Times Magazine did a good piece, but some of it is caricatural. Oh my goodness, there's a working class and they're angry about losing their jobs over the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years. Or they're angry that food prices have gone up. What are we going to say? But it's almost childish. And the fact remains, there's two statistics to remember. 8 million Obama voters switched to Trump in 2016, okay? 80,000 voters made the difference in 2016 in three states, Wisconsin. Trump won by a collective margin across three states, 80,000 votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. I know half those people. Like I said, I've done a lot of reporting, and all they're
You've
either
been to their community.
Well, they're out of work, or they lost their factory job, or they ran the local hardware store that depended on the factory operating, and they're out of business. And their kids suddenly don't have any money for college. Some cases, it's the wife was working in the factory and the husband's now got to go to work. I'm not going to caricature. There's lots of white working class women factory workers who lost their jobs too. And the opposite. Now the wife has got to go to work part time in order to make up for all the wages that they've lost. And this is a gigantic seismic shift in American culture that where, 30, 40 years ago, you were fairly confident that you would move up a rank or your kids would move up a rank, a level in society. And now you can't count on anything. Mm. You can't count on any of that to happen.
I want to end by asking you about the process through which Americans vote and the trust that they have in the system and what happens next. Because you said at the start of the show that, you're adverse to postal voting. It's not something you would want to do. Yeah. You like everybody coming together collectively.
Except in emergencies. I mean, of course. And overseas, soldiers overseas and so on and so forth.
No, sure. And look, it's a broader point, right? You're not advocating for it to be made illegal. It's just not the way you like to do it, right? I think what everyone's going to be quite nervous about in this election is the states were not prepared for 2020 and what was going to happen with postal voting and early voting and COVID. We can accept that as a one-off. We can accept that, the messiness made everything so much worse. As you say, it allowed Trump to start making bigger and bolder claims about the election being rigged that were simply not the case. There was that ugly space that opened in which all these arguments could come through. If states struggle to count postal ballots this time around, if there is a significant delay, if by Wednesday morning in America, Wednesday afternoon, it is so close or so many ballots have not been counted that there is still uncertainty about who has won. Is that going to threaten the process? And should that be tolerated? I mean, does there need to be a bigger crackdown on how quickly these things are decided?
Well, it should be. We should have federal voting rules for every state, but no state will agree to a federal uniform federal voting regulation. But what I really worry about is people talk about violence. I mean, there could be violence and so on and so forth. But what I'm actually practically thinking about is Fox News. In 2020, Fox News called Arizona for Biden. Mm-hmm. And this broke the Trump campaign's back. This was the most important election call, and they were first. Mm-hmm. And Fox News was supposed to be Murdoch was supposed to be Trump's friend and reliably informed that Jared Kushner called Murdoch that night and said, you've got to take this back. You can't say that he won Arizona. And Murdoch told him to stuff it. So I think on election night, I'm going to watch Fox. I'm not going to watch NBC, ABC, or CBS, because if they let their brilliant election analyst, Arnon Mishkin, do his job like he did last time.
They're very good.
And they call it honestly, that might end the election faster than the long recounts that we can count on over the next week in the swing states.
Do you think it's possible? I'm not asking for a prediction, but do you think it's possible that Fox and every other broadcaster could be calling it decisively one way or the other? By that, I mean both candidates have a real shot at a landslide.
No. And I think what I'm talking about is state by state, because everybody's going to be watching the seven states that matter. And if one of them falls early into Harris's camp, Trump's going to go crazy.
Do you think it's possible that could start being called early and it could be in Trump's camp? Do you think both candidates have a real shot at decisively winning this?
Anything's possible, but the problem is with the Electoral College, did I say this earlier? My nightmare is that I didn't say this, that Harris runs up a bigger majority, popular majority, than Hillary Clinton and still loses the Electoral College. Then you might see left-wing riots. Mm. Not kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not inconceivable. Instead of MAGA riots, we'll have left-wing riots. Mm. But no one wants to address the fundamental anti-democratic nature of the Electoral College. No one dares to do it. And Harris, again, Biden, they're mute on the subject. They don't say, we ought to have a popular election with a popular vote where the majority wins. And nobody will say it. Everyone's terrified of upsetting the local party barons.
Well, they also might be concerned about upsetting the swing states in the meantime,
yeah.
who enjoy having the candidates.
They enjoy being the most important states. And that's the argument for the Electoral College, is that if you go to a popular vote majority,
you ignore the center.
Then everybody, all the states that don't matter, will disappear. In other words, the candidates won't visit them. They won't address any of the problems in Nebraska or wherever, and the flyover territory will become even more invisible than it is now. It's already so heavily weighted to what happens on the West Coast and the East Coast, but it is conceivable that she runs up a higher vote total than Hillary did and still loses.
It's been thought that one of the reasons that Harris and Trump have been campaigning in non-swing states, in New York and D.C., is because they're trying to reach that wider vote, because the popular vote, even though it won't determine the outcome,
right,
is indeed very important.
Right, and that's one argument. We haven't talked about Jill Stein, the third-party candidate. She's a great big threat to Harris because she's four square against American policy in Israel and Gaza. And there are a lot of people now who say, we will not vote for Biden, including Arabs in Michigan. We will not vote for Harris until she makes a clear declaration that she's breaking with American policy on Gaza and on Israel. So the other danger is that Jill Stein takes enough votes away from Harris that Trump really does win.
Particularly in those key
states. In those key states,
yeah.
In Michigan and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so Jill Stein is a real, real threat to Harris, which is why I saw her saying, we've got to have peace in Israel and Gaza. She's saying it louder. She's still not giving any kind of concrete plan or saying we'll withhold funds, we'll stop shipping them bombs or whatever. But she's at least getting more strident in her appeals for peace. But the irony, again, this has been going back for a year and a half. Trump, by comparison with Harris, is the peace candidate. He says, I'll end the war between Ukraine and Russia. He doesn't tell you how he's going to do it. He didn't pull out of Afghanistan when he said he wanted to. But he is presenting himself as the peace candidate. He says he also put an end to the carnage in Israel. They just call up Netanyahu. I don't know what he really thinks he can do. Jared Kushner was quoted saying that the Gaza waterfront, seafront would be great to build hotels on. I mean, it would make great vacation development. So who knows what Trump has in mind? But he does have a little bit of an edge on her in terms of saying, I want to stop the bloodshed. Mm-hmm. He does say that.
He does, and he also had 4 years in the Oval Office where, you know, again, some people love this, some people hate this, but he took a more isolationist stance,
yeah.
And it does seem to be the direction many Americans are
going. Yeah. They say, why are we paying for Ukrainian weapons? Why are we paying for Israeli weapons, et cetera, when we can barely scrape together enough money to set the table, to feed our families?
And he actually has the record for it as president.
Can I say one other thing?
Please.
Because it's important to mention. The other problem is that the Bernie Sanders movement is dead. Biden killed off Sanders very adroitly. They say he's gaga, but he's not gaga when it comes to internal party discipline. And the way they killed him off was by not renewing the child income tax credit, where you could take a deduction, it was almost like getting a cash payment based on how many children you had. For the first year, it worked brilliantly. It cut the child poverty rate in half. Everybody said this is the greatest thing. America's a social democracy all of a sudden. And it's all because of Bernie Sanders. They threw him a substantial piece of meat. And at the end of it, Manchin, Schumer, and Biden conspired to let it expire. Mm. Suddenly, inflation was the great danger, not child poverty. And Sanders fought like hell to try to get it renewed. He was outvoted 97-1, and the party abandoned him completely. So poor people, poor black people who really benefited the most from this, and poor Latinos, a lot of them feel they have no reason to vote for Harris, Whereas if they'd renewed the child tax credit, they would have, the expanded child tax credit, they would have had a real motivation to come out and vote because it put a lot of money into a lot of poor people's pockets. That's something that I don't hear anybody talking about on TV, only on Spectator TV.
We get into the nitty-gritty of tax credits on Spectator TV. And yeah. I'm sure we can bet that in the weeks to come, whatever happens, there's going to be a lot of analysis about what went wrong and when. And Rick, you're going to join us again later this week. So
I will.
Look forward to that.
Thank
in the you. Meantime, thank you so much for joining Americano.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Americano. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and send it on to your friends.